Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture and to remind viewers that entertainment is not mindless.
Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 95. On this episode, we are talking about 10 Cloverfield Lane. So I have to get two excellent guests, and I do. Jumping right into the fray is Josh Crabb from Real World Theology and Wade Bearden from the Seeing and Believing podcast over at Christ and Pop Culture, two guys who are super excited to talk about the surprise hit film. And even though there is some controversy about the ending of the film, we are going to talk about it, and we're probably going to spoil it. So this is one of those podcasts where you really, really, really should watch the movie before listening, unless you just want to have the movie completely ruined, because a lot of this film centers around that J.J. Abrams idea of what's in the box, and we're going to talk about what's in the box. So you've been warned. But speaking of Abrams, he says that this movie is a spiritual successor to Cloverfield. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about fear. And we're definitely going to get to your listener questions. So be listening for that. In the meantime, check out realworldtheology.com, where you can see all kinds of new content from our staff, our writers, our contributors. Really, really good stuff. Lots of great reviews and podcasts coming up in the near future. Check us out on Facebook. Join our discussion group on Facebook at Real World Theology. It's slightly separate from our page, so make sure you find that, join that. Follow us on Twitter at Real World Theo. Subscribe to the podcast, iTunes, Feedburner, Stitcher, all those ways. Review the show, please, guys. Please, please, please review the show. It helps so much to get those 5-star ratings. So I hope you enjoy it. It's another great show, another really good conversation, and I think you're going to really, 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 really enjoy this one. So here it is, episode 95, 10 Cloverfield Lane, and Living Beyond Regret.
Because a real man, like real Texas men, are not afraid to show who they really are. That's the other thing Texas.
I will concede that.
Which, hey, it's good too. I'm glad I'm on it, because there's a Houston reference in 10 Cloverfield Lane. Mm-hmm. So I think that just works out really
well.
What
a great segue, Wade. You are a professional. I bet you're the talent of the podcast that you're on.
No. Just the guy. I'm just the guy from Texas.
Just a guy who tells it like it is. Who tells it like it is.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Help. Hey, Josh, have things calm down on your side?
Yeah, I'm actually hiding out in the corner of our basement right now until it's not loud upstairs.
You kind of sound like you're in a basement.
I am in a basement.
With the echo, it's perfect for the bunker. You're in a bunker right now.
Oh. Yeah, there's tons of noises. I think I can hear the Cloverfield monster, but it might just actually be a car over me. I'm not really sure.
I thought it was a helicopter. It's definitely a helicopter.
Oh, it's definitely a helicopter. Sorry.
Well, I am super, super, super excited to have you back, Wade. For some reason, I thought it had been like almost a year since you'd been on, but I saw Skype tells me that you were on in October.
I was on for The Martian.
Oh, so there you go. So
anyway, I guess it wasn't very memorable, but
no, it just, I was there. Well, once you do so many of these a month, you just kind of, you know, you know what I'm talking about.
I was on
about?
Hold the entire time, and you thought that I
that's right.
And I was like, guys, come on, I have a lot to say.
We keep interrupting. Like, why do they keep interrupting me?
Yeah.
You were on mute the entire time.
No, but yeah, so I was on The Martian, and I know it was on American Sniper, but I think I was on like twice last year.
Yeah, well, American Sniper was the one that I thought you were on like a year ago.
Yeah. So it's been a little bit, but I'm really excited to be back too. And my podcast, like you mentioned when you asked me, I was out of town when my podcast talked about it. So my co-host Kevin McLenathan, he had Joel Mayward on, which I think he's been on your show too. Mm-hmm. And so they got to talk about 10 Cloverfield Lane, and I was a little sad because
super jelly.
Yeah. So now I get to parade this podcast around and be like, oh, you guys talked about it there. Well, I talked about it here.
I'm not saying this one's better because I was on it, but it's not worse because I wasn't on it. So
like, well, I had Fizz and Josh. So
wait, I thought that was you talking, Fizz. Like you're like, it was because of you that this podcast is good.
Oh, no. Yeah, that's what, I think he was saying that.
No, not me. I'm talking to all, it's all Wade, man. All Wade, all day. It's Wade, tell it like it is, Bearden. Like, if you get Wade, I'm from Texas, Houston, bang, 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 Bearden.
It's so weird because people who know me, they're like, if someone's going to bring you bad news, let it be Wade because he does it in such a nice way. Which I'm like not, I guess, like that's, you know, it's
you're
not.
You're that guy. You're the bad news guy.
I'm just the guy that's like, hey, you know, I think that was okay, but maybe we could go in a different direction. You did really good, but let's like move towards this direction. And so.
No, maybe you should just be a doctor then, because that's what they do, right? Well, they're usually not very nice about it. You'd be the best doctor, because usually there's that, you know, there's the joke that you go to the doctor and it's one of the only people that you pay to insult you. You know, it's like, well, your cholesterol's high, you're overweight, and you're probably going to die soon.
I appreciate how much bacon you've been eating, but why don't we just, why don't we kind of take that and maybe pull it in another direction? Let's do it.
Oh, well, so you're getting to team up with Josh, who I don't think you've ever been on the show with.
That's not true.
Josh! Did you do Martian? Did you do the Martian?
No, it's Fury.
You don't remember any podcast that I'm on.
You know how many people. So this is the thing. The positive and negative about the format that we have on this show is positive. We have so many voices, so many great people who get to add their ideas, their theology, their, if you like the word, worldview to the discussions about current movies. And we get to all engage it together. Like I imagine us holding hands, you know, in a big field with flowers and butterflies. That's the beauty of the format that we have on this podcast. The bad part is there are so many people in that circle holding hands. I can't remember who did what because everyone's equally amazing in my eyes.
But and Josh remembers and he's on it a lot too.
Well, Josh isn't on that much. I try to keep it to a minimum.
Well, I forgive you then. I forgive you.
Because, I mean, if every episode could be on Star Wars, Josh would be on. But
that's in a couple of years,
I was going to say, if Disney came to their senses, they'd realize they could just put out a Star Wars movie every week and they'd make a pile of money.
They would. And no one would ever get tired of it. I mean, someone would get tired of it, but not enough people for them not to still make money.
Oh, for sure.
Probably true.
That's until Zack Snyder had to make a Star Wars movie, and then everyone would hate it.
Well, why would they do that? They're going to keep letting J.J. Abrams do it because, much like 10 Cloverfield Lane, they know that J.J. Abrams has something to do with it. I'm so good at transitions. Oh, so good at
that
transitions.
That segue made my head spin.
That if J.J. Abrams has something to do with it, at least right now, then there's a better than not chance that it's going to be pretty decent because the poor man Spielberg. We got the poor man Spielberg who loves to tell stories in the way that I think people love listening to him or watching them and engaging with them now, which is the mystery box. It's you know, oh, come back next episode because you still don't know what's in the box. Like he's got that as his kind of pinnacle storytelling trait, and people love it right now. People love the, you know, the almost clickbait thing, not quite like Walking Dead clickbait bad, but it's the, you know, you'll never believe what's in the box, click here, you know. That's almost J.J. Abrams, except it's actually fun to watch. And you know, you're not getting like a masterpiece typically. I mean, we all love The Force Awakens, you know, it was great, but you know, no one thinks it's a masterpiece. Well, some people think it's a masterpiece, but you know, the average person doesn't think it's a masterpiece, but it's a lot of fun. Most things J.J. Abrams do are a lot of fun or, you know, done well enough.
Yeah.
So,
I liked Force Awakens a lot. Yeah.
Yeah.
I like Super 8. You know, I like Mission Impossible 3.
Exactly. I mean, I really enjoyed the Star Trek reboot. Let's just name everything that he's done. I love
Regarding Henry, that film he wrote with Harrison Ford. Yeah. He didn't direct it, but it was still really good.
I have just come back from 3 years in the future to tell you that the new Indiana Jones movie is actually better than you'd think, because somehow J.J. Abrams had something to do with it. So, but I mean, so 10 Cloverfield Lane. We already almost in and of itself, the movie being in existence was almost the box, right? Like, we didn't know about it for a long time. You had a cast that wasn't super, you know, super well known outside of John Goodman. And even then he, you know, he's been coing it up a little bit. So it's not like he's been like a super superstar. He's just fairly well known. You get, Dan Trachtenberg, who had never actually directed a full-length feature, and you kind of film it all in secret or semi-secret, where enough people don't ask questions, and then boom, like a month and a half or so right before it's supposed to release your first trailer, no one knew about it, and people were like, "Oh my god, this is like Cloverfield," and you're like, "Why are y'all talking like that? Why aren't you using real words? Why are you just making noises?" And it's really, really crazy. So when was the, like, since it was kept under wraps until the very last minute? I feel like we probably all should have been able to come at this, like I'm hoping anyone who gets to see this movie did, which is with a blank slate. You know, I knew nothing about this film. I was ready to be completely surprised. So, Wade, what did you think of 10 Cloverfield Lane, especially since you didn't get to talk about it on Christ and Pop Culture? The Seeing and Believing podcast, found at ChristandPopCulture.com.
Hey, that was good. Yeah. The one thing about this movie is... when it added that Cloverfield title. So it was a movie that was kind of out there.
Mm-hmm.
But when it added that Cloverfield title, I think it added some excitement. It definitely was good for marketing.
It was great for marketing, right?
Yeah, I kind of wish that maybe it didn't do that, because when you go into the film, you kind of know. Is this a spoiler? We'll do this.
Attention. If you've not seen 10 Cloverfield Lane, please go see 10 Cloverfield Lane, because we're going to spoil the crap out of it. And it's something that I don't think you will enjoy much. Like, there's some movies that you can know the ending and you can still be like, "Oh, it was an adventure on how to get there." This is a mystery box movie. If you know what's in the box, it's definitely going to ruin how you interact with the film emotionally. So,
Yeah. See, well, okay, coming at it, it was kind of, I don't know if you'd say spoiled, but you kind of know that there are going to be these alien type creatures, right? So some of the tension in that, for me, I guess I assume that, maybe it wasn't right of me, but some of the tension was, is what John Goodman's character Howard saying true? And I said, well, yeah, I think it is, but to the extent that it's true.
Yeah.
You know, maybe there's some edge there. But I really liked it. I thought that it was a great piece. I thought it was, it had some relatively nice themes that were attached to the movie. Mm-hmm. I thought it was exciting. I liked the ending. I thought the ending was a whole lot of fun. We can go into more
details.
We'll talk
about the ending closer to the end, because I think it's going to be a culmination of where we go thematically. And when you're talking about what you know going into the film, I'd say this, kind of reflecting about this film and its correlation, or at least the marketing. So, Wade, you're saying that you went in expecting there to be some kind of monster, like some kind of physical monster, alien, sea creature, something, because it had the Cloverfield name. Now, I had heard enough to know that, like, it wasn't obviously like The Next Day. Like, it wasn't necessarily like a sequel to Cloverfield. So I didn't know what to expect. But I did expect there to be something that was bigger than the characters would understand. And because of that, actually, watching this movie reminded me of when I watched season one of The Walking Dead. And because in season one of The Walking Dead, you know that as a view, like the viewer knows that there's likely going to be zombies, right? Mm-hmm. You don't know when you're going to see them for the first time. You don't know how they're going to show up. And most importantly, the character that you're following has no concept of what had happened. And so you get to discover along with the main character what it looks like for the average person to discover something that they didn't get to see along with, like, you know, national news coverage or anything like that. You know, when we're watching Cloverfield, we're seeing news reports. We're seeing, like, them interacting with the monster in New York and things like that. Here, we're with a character who, based on the title, we kind of believe that maybe there's something going on, but I'm on the edge of my seat going, but is it really? Is this just, you know, I didn't hear anything about any gas or any nuclear things in the first one. So, you know, I'm under the impression there's something, but I'm loving that story unfolding, not knowing what's coming next with an idea that there is probably something coming next. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. And there's definitely this great amount of tension as you try to figure out what the scope of it is. Mm-hmm. So did it happen in New York City and Howard just take them into the bunker? Mm-hmm. Did it happen nearby? What's the tension of it? I think it does extremely well. I really like the scene where the character of Leslie comes and she has obviously been affected by the virus. Mm-hmm. And so you get the sense, okay, there was a great reveal at that point. And so you know something's happening.
Yeah, now and something
just,
is happening.
Just about that turn, too, Howard makes a turn. And I love this about John Goodman's performance, is that at times he is this man on the edge, and then other times he kind of has a fatherly angle to him. And the film kind of builds that up, gives us a slight reveal, and then lets us just hang out with him for a while and build this kind of family. And so that, to me, was a great kind of turn, because you never really know where you're at with this movie, even though you might say, okay, we're going to get to a point eventually where there are going to be these creatures.
Yeah. Okay, so Josh, like, what were your, you know, I assume you're in a very similar boat, so I'm asking under that assumption, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but what I'd really want to know is kind of like, what were your first impressions walking out of this film?
Man, what were my first impressions? Oh, geez. Like, the first things that I thought when I was walking out is I was kind of skeptical on just the movie as a whole when I left. I was kind of like, yeah, I mean, this was, I mean, very interesting, very tightly done, very well acted, everything like that. I'm not sure if I really liked the ending that much. Mm-hmm. And as I sat back and thought about it more and more, I realized that I enjoyed this movie the more I thought about it, and eventually just came around on it, really in the sense of that there was so much going on in this movie that I don't think I understood just on a level of once I was done seeing the film, but getting a chance to reflect on it and writing the review that I did for it, I realized when I was done, I've been finding this a lot with a couple different movies that I've reviewed lately, is by the time I'm done writing about it, I liked it more than I did when I started.
Interesting. Yeah. Yeah.
And just kind of unpacking a lot of that. And so I really liked it. And this is the only movie, I think, maybe besides Hail Caesar this year, that I actually want to go back and see again. Mm-hmm. I wanted to before we did the podcast, but I just didn't get a chance to go see it again.
Yeah.
But I really like, I think some of the value in the movies that I like the most out of a given year are the movies that obviously you want to go back to, you know, like my wife and I are going back and revisiting Spotlight again, you know, from last year. And it's just like the movies that we really care about and the movies that have really made an impact on me are the ones that I want to go back and see. And so it's like, this means something to me that I want to go see 10 Cloverfield Lane again. You know, I mean, and I'll probably will see it maybe like two more times this year. And I'm not going to apologize for that, because I like it. And
because you're from Wisconsin, you just tell it like it is.
In the north and in the deep south, we tell it like it is.
We just tell like it is, from the top to the bottom.
Right. It's somewhere in Missouri is the mushy middle where they don't say anything.
Yeah. Flip floppers.
Well, I mean, they say a lot, but they never really say anything.
Yeah, right.
Well, so, okay, I think the thing about this film is, you know, there was a section of people that expected it to be like Cloverfield.
Ah, have those suckers.
Yeah, they were told that it was not going to be like Cloverfield by, you know, by Abrams, by, you know, the director, by probably any of the actors. And without giving, you know, without giving too much away, they were just like, look, it's not like that. But they're still expecting it to be like that. And it ends up much like Cloverfield. I was actually describing this to somebody today because they'd never seen the first Cloverfield. And they said, well, what is it? And I said, well, it's really cool because it's something that defies like a genre. Like it actually mixes two genres. It's like a found footage kind of film. And a monster movie, like a big budget monster movie. And so it kind of combines these two genres that you don't typically see, because usually found footage is very, like, it tends to be a fairly personal story and, doesn't span a whole lot. And then, you know, monster films are usually epic and Godzilla type things, Pacific Rim, you know, those tend not to be very, found footagey type things. So it spans these genres and does it well. And I would say, in my personal opinion, but I'd like to hear what you guys think. I think 10 Cloverfield Lane does that too. So if someone comes up to you, Josh, and says, 10 Cloverfield Lane, what is it? What kind of film is this? Like, what do you say? Do you say that it's a horror, suspense, thriller, sci-fi? Like, what do you tell them?
Yeah, geez. Well, because I don't think it's a sci-fi film. I think it's more of like sort of a confined psychological thriller of sorts. That's probably the best explanation for it. Even though the movie's incredibly fun, and you could even almost describe it as a survival film too. So it's kind of like a one location survival thriller movie that ends like sci-fi.
So many hyphens. Well, so Wade, would you like? Mm-hmm. Have you kind of come to a consensus on what you would describe it as?
You know, I think the beauty of this film is that it works a number of different angles, and it moves back and forth between those different angles. So there are times when it feels like a domestic drama. You have Mary Elizabeth Winstead, her character Michelle. Mm-hmm. She's leaving her fiance. Then you have the relationship with her and Emmett and Howard in the house. Other times it seems like a horror film. Other times it seems like a crime mystery drama. Other times it's a science fiction film. So the film moves about these angles very well. And I think that is what keeps it so entertaining. And I think it sets it above what it could have been. Because this could have been kind of a dry story set in one location, but it really digs deep into all these different emotions that would come along in a situation like this. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the beauty. So I think I would say, hey, it's not your action-packed monster film, but it has all these different elements to tell a compelling story. I don't know if I would say it's a deep character study, but it is a character study about the themes of fear and fight, flight, and the monster within us all. And we can talk about that later. But I think it balances a number of those arenas well.
So I like to have Josh on anytime there's a movie where a female is trapped against her will in a small confined space.
Is it because he's been trapped in a small space before, or he's mm-hmm. trapped people in small spaces?
That's true.
It's because I think of him as a woman.
And, okay. That was highly insulting. How first of all, how dare you?
How dare you? No. So Josh, so like I said, we talked about Room, the really great film that starred Brie Larson. And lots of people would compare it to this film. I mean, obviously, for some very big plot points, you know, you have a woman who is more, you know, held against her will in a confined space by a man that is ultimately trying to get out for different reasons, to different results. But the whole thing of a woman being subject to someone else's will is a very powerful theme. But how do you see this as different than Room, or do you see it as that different than Room?
Yeah, I mean, the comparisons between that and Room are between 10 Cloverfield Lane and Room do. I mean, they have incredible similarities. I think, you know, in the same fact that I think that both of them are making choices to try and get out of a situation. Eventually they sort of come to this point of no return. Now, granted, you know, with Brie Larson's character, Ma, she makes the terrible decision of kind of putting her son in the line of fire by, like, he's the only one that could possibly get them out of this situation. Whereas, Mary Elizabeth Winstead's character, it's Michelle, right?
Yeah.
That's the name of the character. Okay. I'm just making sure I'm not doing this wrong. But Michelle, it's firmly in her hands, and granted, she's working in tandem with someone else. The interesting part about that is when they both get to their end games and, you know, Jacob is ultimately fake dies, you know, he's dead, quote unquote, and is able to get them out. And what's the other guy's name? Dang it. Why am I forgetting? What am I forgetting? Emmett? There's only three characters in this movie and you can't even remember their names. But yes, Emmett, and how he ultimately dies, essentially taking responsibility for their plan. Mm-hmm. So there's this amazing similarity where they're both in this trusting relationship with another person, where as one is able to successfully get them out of it, the other one dies, and essentially her end game is that she has to get out, or she is likewise going to either be trapped or what she probably assumes is dead. But there's definitely like a measure of psychology involved in both of these cases. Whereas Ma, you know, I mean, there's a lot more abuse and like overt abuse happening, obviously, in this situation. She's been forcibly removed from her family. Michelle is hiding from what seems like the end of the world or an alien invasion or the Russians or whatever crazy theory Howard's come up with next, which is an amazing amount of theories that get thrown out as to what Howard subscribes to. But, you know, she essentially has to take the bull by the horns in this situation and get out of it. And but she's the psychological nature of her struggle is really like, can she trust Howard? He seems like kind of a nice, genuine guy. Emmett is vouching for him, you know, until mm-hmm. Emmett gets his head blown off. And spoiler alert. And which, by the way, that was probably out of all of the, I guess, minor to major twists that happened in this movie, that was probably the one I was least expecting, for reasons that go with the fact that basically the movie set up that Howard's such a nice guy, he would never actually do that. And then clearly his breaking point is shooting Emmett right in the face. But, you know, her psychology and the tension and the thrill in that in all of 10 Cloverfield Lane and only in the first half of Room is really that she doesn't know whether to trust him. There seems to be conflicting information as to whether she can or not. And there seems to be conflicting information from outside and inside that is really it leaves even us in doubt. Like I felt as an audience member that I didn't know if Howard was trustworthy or not. And there was still a part of me that was like, this movie's named 10 Cloverfield Lane, but who knows? Maybe at the end of the movie, everything's fine. You know, she goes outside and she, you know, kind of goes into the dusk and hears the frogs croaking and, you know, the movie is just over. And, you know, the bunker blows up and Howard's gone or whatever. Or I thought, honestly, Howard would get out or something. So, you know, there was just these layers upon layers of information and doubt and truth and all these things that were sort of coming at you that as an audience member, it was a really big thrill ride. And they balanced it all so well that it never felt like you were being cheated or manipulated or anything like that. So
and definitely give you something way, way different. So this is...
Yeah.
In no way Room. Tonally, like...
No. Besides the fact that there's a woman in a bunker and they both get out of it.
No, okay, yeah, so that's good. That's good, mm-hmm. because I think you took us through all the emotions that, well, and thematics that we get in 10 Cloverfield that actually are different than Room. And I was curious that if anyone, and Wade, you're welcome to try as well, because I honestly didn't think of Room when I thought of 10 Cloverfield Lane. Mm. And maybe that says something about me that I don't know, but I felt it was a different movie. Sure, you still have a female lead, which we're getting a lot more of, which I think we can all agree is, you know, kind of a long time coming, but I didn't really see tons thematically except for them needing to get out of where they were because I thought Cloverfield was doing weaving a whole lot of other stuff.
I think for me, yeah, it was just kind of the woman locked in. You know, Room is a movie about dealing with trauma. I think that ultimately when you kind of boil down mm-hmm. 10 Cloverfield Lane, you're dealing with individuals who are fearful of the future, who are fearful of moving forward. So mm-hmm. that we can call that flight, but it looks differently. Sometimes it is physically running away, like we see Michelle's character do. Sometimes it's staying still, like Emmett and his character does. He has this scholarship to go to college, and he doesn't leave. And then for some people, it is bunkering down and trying to recreate the past that is no longer there. And that is what Howard does. He is trying to flee his turmoil by recreating it, by recreating a perfect place that will not harm him if a nuclear war happens, and trying to literally recreate his daughter through Michelle, through mm-hmm. the clothes she wears, through all these different elements. Ultimately, I like this film better than Room. I think technically the blocking and the shot choices with this story is much better. I think the storytelling's much better. For me, Room was very emotional, but the storytelling process it really didn't work for me as well as it should have. Not a bad film. It was an okay film. I think when you look at 10 Cloverfield Lane, you see someone who's really digging in to develop their characters a little bit better, more than just emotionally, and more than just putting a girl in a place where she's being abused and making us feel sad about it, but actually digging into what that means. And so I think there are some similarities, but I liked 10 Cloverfield Lane much, much better.
That's really funny, because I think that right there is a fighting opinion based on some of the reactions I had when people finally saw Room and just thought it was one of the best films of the year, which, I mean, I think it was a really good film. Maybe we have to put up a poll now on the Real World Theology discussion page, which did you, which was better, Room or 10 Cloverfield
Lane?
Which
woman locked away?
Yeah, nice.
Your favorite. Which exactly same Jeez. Movie?
Yeah.
That's not the exact same movie. Well, okay, so Wade, I think you're actually hitting on something that I was curious about too, mm-hmm. because I was reading, especially talking about genre, Alyssa Wilkinson kind of claims in her review of the film that, and I believe rightfully so, that apocalyptic movies, which is a word that we haven't used yet for this genre, but I think fits. She says that in apocalyptic movies or shows like The Walking Dead or Battlestar Galactica, it brings out people's true colors. It's kind of what apocalyptic things do. And I would also add that monster movies make us face our own demons as humans. So we get a lot of a lot of character work through, a lot of that character development that you're talking about, more than just emotionally, Wade. What do we learn about humanity through Michelle and Emmett and Howard?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good question. I don't think it's especially deep in that it's mining super deep. I think it's telling a great story. I think it's really developing these characters. You know, we are learning about fear. We are learning about the monster within. It doesn't necessarily become the most profound film, but I think it says something about that. I think it says something about how we view women as well. Mm-hmm. There's a really interesting moment in the film. Probably, I don't know if I'd say like my favorite moment, but my favorite like moment was when they are playing this charade game, and Emmett is trying to get Howard to guess Little Women. And so he says, you know, he guesses little, and then for women, he points to Michelle.
Yeah.
And Howard can, he sees her as a girl. He sees her as a princess, but he cannot call her a woman. And I think it says something about how women are sometimes viewed in society, mm-hmm. how women are sometimes treated. So I think there's something definitely there that is worth exploring with this movie.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Well, I would say, yeah, I think that's a powerful scene for that exact point. And we learn a whole lot because I think we want to think that that's not how a lot of, like, especially men or older men see any woman that's like younger than them. But it's probably a little too revealing. Josh, what did you see? What did you learn about humanity from Mr. Howard and Michelle and Emmett?
Well, kind of touching on Wade's previous point, I felt like, you know, how there was this this flight aspect of it. But I kind of saw this more. I think I wrote down in my notes throughout when I was watching the movie is that it was all regret. Like all of them had major regrets. And that this movie was about the regrets. They all had regrets, and it was all wiped out essentially. You know, like at one point, Emmett says, you know, it's kind of like lucky us when he's giving a speech about having that bus ticket mm-hmm. To be able to go to college on a scholarship, and he just stayed put. And you know, he was kind of talking about that decision, and Michelle talked about. This had that story about a little girl and her doing nothing because that little girl was like abused by her dad, mm-hmm. you know, and she says she panics and she runs when things get hard, whereas Emmett is staying put. And I think it's all about these regrets, and they feel like being in this bunker, they are all kind of living with their own regrets. And Howard's regrets are, you know, maybe that he didn't get enough time with his daughter. And whereas the two of them are sort of being able to realize that and realize that there's more to live for beyond that. They sort of come to a realization that they want to get out of here because they kind of want to see for themselves or figure out what's going on to kind of live beyond their regret. Whereas Howard, like Wade, you said, he sort of wants to reconstruct his reality of when he wasn't regretful of what was going on in his life, when he had his daughter, when things were better, these kind of things. And what I saw is that in the face, something interesting, you know, about a movie like this and about a movie, an apocalyptic type movies, you don't really get a lot of meditations very often on like what people regret, you know, after an apocalypse happened. A lot of times apocalypse can be seen as sort of like this wiping out and sort of a brand new slate, you know, characters that may have been weak or infirm beforehand are stronger mm-hmm. in the apocalypse because they get a chance to lead. Or, you know, I mean, I think of like someone like Merle in the first season of The Walking Dead, who goes from being just kind of a jerk to like a psychopath, you know.
Or Daryl. I mean, I think
right, exactly.
You know, he went from being like a racist redneck to everyone's favorite character.
Right, exactly. And so I feel like all of them are struggling with these regrets. And it's interesting, you know, how Emmett says at the end of his speech, he says like, you know, they're living despite the regrets. And he says, you know, kind of lucky us. And, you know, we're here, but is it living? And he never really gets to, he never really gets to realize the chance to live a new life because his life is ended shortly after that by Howard when he takes responsibility for their plan that gets foiled. And, you know, I just think it was interesting to learn about when you're in this confined space, you have this opportunity to either forge a new life or to live with your regrets. And Michelle decides to make something of what's going on and figure it out for herself instead of just trusting Howard's word, whereas Howard's trying to live in the past and sort of ignore his regrets by reliving when his life was better. Mm-hmm. Which is what we can tend to do, what we can tend to do often in our own lives. When we're either alone or isolated or whatever, we go back to what's familiar. So we don't end up actually growing or getting to be a bigger, better person or growing or casting off old habits or old sins or whatever. I thought that was a really poignant that I kind of wish they maybe done a little bit more, but it may have felt a little bit too on the nose to do it a little bit more. And I like the mystery aspects of Howard that we're not really 100% sure, even after the movie is concluded, if he was trustworthy or crazy, or if he was, if we should sympathize with him or we should make him a monster or whatever. I think that was a really bold choice, and it paid off really well to not just make him like the looming bad guy at all times. And that's, you know, again, that goes back to who Goodman is. He's kind of this big dude, but he's kind of a softy, you know, like, come on, he's Fred Flintstone. We all love him.
I think when you start talking about Howard too, that goes back to my movie or my monster movie comparison about this film in the first place. Because I think the best monster movies, and I go back to Godzilla from last year or the year before.
The 1998 one? Or
no, definitely not. That was definitely not last year or the year before. Where I think some of the best monster movies are the ones where the monster is slowly revealed. Mm-hmm. And in this film, anytime we think Howard is harmless or that he's going to start shying away and become sympathetic... Or maybe it's not that he's not harmless. Maybe he's just paranoid, so he acts weird. So we can have that sympathy. We almost immediately turn around and get bit, and we see how dangerous the monster really is because he's slowly growing and slowly becoming more the monster. We realize that he's the monster of the film, more so than the monsters that we'll get to see later.
And the beauty of this movie is its intimate focus. And that's what I liked about the first Cloverfield movie. It was very intimate. It was really kind of a love story, and I dug it. I think it's a fantastic movie. This one is an intimate film as well. And even though we don't get the intimate feel of a found footage drama, we do have kind of a closer look at these characters, and we see that through the cinematography. The shots are very close. We have a lot of great close-ups. Mm-hmm. When you go outside and there's the big battle with Michelle and the alien, if you look at the number of shots, a lot of them are close. She's running, and instead of giving a wide shot of her running, Trachtenberg moves the camera to her face, and it's this really close-up. And in one way, it's very claustrophobic when we're in the bunker, these close-up shots, you know, choosing when we get the wide shots or not. But then when we go outside, it still gives us this closeness to the character. And really, that's what makes, I think, Cloverfield so successful, is it doesn't just say, oh, this is about the characters. But this is a movie from the technical aspects of the franchise to the storytelling. It is about the characters. And when you do that, you give characters like Michelle a chance to grow. You give John Goodman's character multiple shades. Instead of just being this mustache-twirling villain, you never really kind of know where he's at. And like Josh said, at the end, you know he's a bad person, but like, did they maybe cause it, right? When Emmett said, hey, I was trying to get your gun, did he feel like the only way to protect himself and their way of life was to kill him? Now, that wasn't the right thing to do, and he did it in a very horrible way. But there's this, you know, it's complex. And ultimately, I think he's a villain, right? Yeah. But they let us kind of wallow in that for a little while, and I think that that's beneficial to the movie.
Hmm. What's really interesting, especially with Josh talking about his view of this film thematically being about regret, and having him explain that after we've kind of explored Howard and explored Michelle and explored Emmett to some degree, I didn't think of the word regret, but it makes a lot of sense. But the word I did think about was fear, because I'm thinking that fear was leading to these regrets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because I think, you know, like I said, Josh, like you said, Emmett never leaves the town, even though he has that scholarship, because he's afraid.
Yeah.
You know, Howard is a doomsday prepper because he's afraid that he's going to lose things, that he's going to lose, because you can almost sense that he knows that he's a little off, and whatever he's done, he's lost his family. Mm-hmm. And he's afraid that bad things are going to continue to happen. So he's prepping. He lives in a constant state of fear. And Michelle, we learn, like, it makes a little more sense a little further into the film, what she's done with some of her exposition and sharing with Emmett. But Michelle always runs away from conflict in relationships, or especially in relationships, you know, emotionally and physically. Mm-hmm. Like, she'll physically move out of the relationship and emotionally just kind of checks out. Mm-hmm. So all these people are basically crippled by this fear. And it's interesting to me to see what turns the corner, because Howard never really turns that corner. Howard has fully embraced fear. He's fully embraced that mindset. But it's through connection, maybe, that would have never happened any other way. You know, Emmett's never really going to tell people about his scholarship unless he thinks it's the end of the world. And he's trapped with somebody else who, you know, is the only sane person that he can talk to. And the same thing with Michelle. Michelle can't run. Michelle can't physically leave the bunker. So she has to, and she can't make an emotional connection with Howard. So she ends up making this emotional connection with Emmett. And this beautiful thing happens, even though, you know, we don't get a full chance because of Emmett's untimely death to see it play out fully for him. But once they connect, there's this really great thing that happens where there's like this, they start to think about something besides themselves. And once you start to think of something besides yourself, you can actually like leave fear. And because once you start thinking of something outside yourself, there's a certain amount of love that you can have for another person, you know, not necessarily romantic love, but like this compassion that you can have for another person. And, you know, if I want to make it a Sunday school thing, then, you know, we're told that like, there's no fear in love. And if it was perfect love, then it would cast out all fear. But obviously all fear was not cast out in this, and rightfully so. But there's this element that whenever we're crippled by something, we can look outside of ourselves, not inside ourselves, but outside ourselves, and kind of nudge ourselves in that direction.
And there's definitely this interesting contrast between the small world of the bunker, mm-hmm, and the bigger world where there is some sort of connection to the universe, right? It's not this closed system. It's this very open system. So there's a nice, I would say, kind of visual but also storytelling contrast between this closed system and the screws tightening to this outside world where you realize that, sure, there are real big issues in the universe, but at the same time, there's huge potential. It's much bigger than you imagined. And so I think that there's a contrast there that kind of works nicely with the narrative.
Mm. Yeah, and the interesting thing is that I was I know I shared this with you, Mikey, but I was listening to Dan Trachtenberg talk about the movie on the Slash Film podcast, because I guess he's old friends with the guys from that show. And he was talking about he had this concept of when he was shooting that scene when she got out of the bunker for the first time and takes off her helmet and everything, and you hear the great sound design, mm-hmm, and everything, that he wanted to actually shoot that spherically or like in IMAX to kind of get like a bigger feel to it, and it just didn't end up working out that way. But I love, my favorite part about just like all of what you guys have been saying is that, like, I think one of my favorite parts of this film is maybe something that is kind of understated, but I think is really, it felt really obvious to me when I was reflecting on the film afterwards, is that she gets out, she sort of gets her, like you were saying, Mikey, she sort of is able to get out of fear and get out of this bunker and sort of move on with her life. But then the part that I like more than anything else, and I'm spoiling my favorite moment, but I think this is a great way to kind of cap the conversation, is that, you know, when she gets out and she sees the alien, her words are just perfect. You know, she just goes, oh, come on. Like, out of all the things that she's just gotten off, she's just gotten out of this box and she's gotten out of this bunker, mm-hmm, and managed to escape. And it's like, there's still more stuff to overcome. And I feel like that's a really good, that's a good narrative metaphor for like what life is really like when you're able to conquer your fears. Like, you don't conquer fear and it's just gone. Like, there's just new challenges that lay before you. And so it's like sort of this reality of like, oh, I made it out of there. Oh no, and I have to deal with something else. Like, come on. Like, there really are aliens out there. Mm-hmm. Well, and so I love that. I love that little thing right at the end. I loved that part of the movie.
Well, I think one of the most poignant things that I read about this is if you look at this as, I think rightfully so, as a metaphor for abuse of women or the subjugation of women in any kind of way, you know, from the very, very worst, most despicable types to the sadly socially acceptable types of subjugation. This movie was kind of pointed to as it's one of the first ones that gets it, because most of the time, a lot of times when we see women kind of oppressed in film, something happens, they overcome, and then life is good and it's done. Like right. they've overcome the either the fear that was holding them down, the man that was holding them down, the specific piece of oppression that was holding them down, but then everything is okay. In 10 Cloverfield Lane, if you take that as a metaphor that I think is obviously running through this narrative, you get to take it one step further and say, actually, this is probably a lot more what being abused is like. You might get out of the situation, but you're not done like fighting battles. Like there, you always have another battle, whether it's it's another abusive situation because, you know, unfortunately we live in a pretty not perfect world and a not even, you know, even in America, a very not perfect society that is sexist and doesn't treat women fairly in most cases. So you're either going into another abusive situation, which, you know, the metaphor for the aliens like trying to kill her, or you're just having to deal with the fallout of that abuse or that subjugation or that oppression, like whatever word you want to use. And so it never really ends. So even if you get out of the bunker, there's still something else.
And I think the film wraps up her character really well. You know, she escapes, she fights back. She could have stayed, you know, she could have stayed in her flight, could have been staying in the bunker and really just kind of not choosing to battle. Mm-hmm. But she doesn't. And she gets out of the bunker and she has to fight to survive.
Yeah.
The real, I think, powerful moment comes when she's leaving and she hears something on the radio. You can go north of Baton Rouge to a safe zone, right, or refugee camp, or you can go to Houston to fight. And she makes that turn to Houston, and it really just kind of shows that she is a changed person. She's not fighting for survival anymore. Mm-hmm. She's fighting to make the world better. She's fighting to reckon the situation. And I think that concludes nicely. It's not anything incredibly deep in of itself, but I think for a film like this, it gives us just enough to chew on that really makes it, you know, stick the landing.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's the thing. I think as much as anything could, if we're going to follow that metaphor, that's the way to end the metaphor, because the way you end it is saying, okay, she got out of the bunker. She maybe thought that it was over, but there's something else. So then she fights off the alien attack. And then she moves forward saying, it's never going to be over.
Mm-hmm.
There's always going to be a fight. I have to choose how I'm going to, am I going to let the fight happen to me? Or am I going to, you know, face this head on? And, you know, it, like I said, acknowledges that the fight's not over. And I love that. Something I wanted to do, because I think it's going to allow us to hit on anything that we've missed, is we actually had a number of you who were very excited, or listeners who were very excited that we were doing this film, I think for very obvious reasons. And you guys gave us a lot of questions and a lot of statements to react to. So I wanted to kind of throw a whole bunch of these questions that you guys gave us back out there for Wade and Josh to get their reaction. So
let's do it.
Yeah.
Since we're already kind of there, I'm going to start with Gene Gerger's his comment was he just wants to know, like I said, good or bad, what our reaction was to the end of the film. Because for him, he said that he wasn't a fan of what I'm guessing is coming out of the bunker and then there being aliens. because it's so, you know, it's so tonally different than the inside piece. So what was your reaction? Because for him, it kind of, since he wasn't a fan, it shaded his overall opinion of the film.
So I thought, and Josh, I guess I'll jump in front of you.
That's fine.
I apologize for not being the courteous guest.
Sorry, not sorry.
But you know, I mentioned before, I liked how it moves between genres. And I think that when it comes out, it does that well. And I really enjoyed it. I thought it was a lot of fun. It could have ended and maybe she saw an alien and that was the movie just blacked out at that point. But I liked how she fought. And I think what it does too is, you know, you expect in a movie like this, it to be one or the other. Goodman's character is either wrong and he's just a villain trying to deceive her. That's kind of a simple way to look at it. Or he's right. He's really a good guy. He knew it all along. He wants to keep her safe. It gets so complicated when you say he was right, but he was still just a big jerk, right? It really just adds just a complexity to the movie. And I think it really looks at people who, okay, yeah, maybe you're right, but that doesn't mean you're good. And that to me worked for the ending. And then, of course, just on a pure joyful level, I thought it was just so much fun. I like Winstead. I think she's a fantastic actress. And to see her kind of battling the aliens and making, you know, getting that whiskey or liquor or whatever bottle it was, the alcoholic beverage, and creating a bomb from it, I thought that was a lot of fun. And so I really like the ending.
Cool.
Yeah.
Josh?
And what do you think those were? Do you think those were like organic spaceships or something?
I heard Josh Larson on Film Spotting say this, and it makes sense. In the first Cloverfield, you have this creature, and coming out of it were other creatures. And yeah. In this one, you kind of get that same. Now, the creatures look different, but you still get the same feel. They're this big creature and these smaller creatures coming out. So I would say organic, yes.
Yeah, and that's what I thought too. I thought his explanation, or like, I think I remember listening to that and asking the question, like, but what about the spaceships? They look like organic spaceships. That's kind of what I wrote in my notes, is that they were like organic in some way. I thought it was interesting. So,
into space and, whales.
Oh, I guess I'm supposed to say something. No, space whales are very important. Star Wars Rebels.
Doctor Who.
Another Star Wars reference. I got one in. Anyways, how I thought about the ending is, like, I feel like sometimes this ending felt a lot like, and the comparisons abound, and Trachtenberg and Abrams have been pretty out about the fact that they wanted this to kind of feel like a long extended Twilight Zone episode or something like that. And or you can think about like an Alfred Hitchcock Presents, and like the mm-hmm. comparisons to somewhat to Psycho have been done. You know, like the Next Picture Show podcast had a great podcast on the comparison between Psycho and 10 Cloverfield Lane. And I loved the ending. I think I would have been with you that almost like she would have seen the alien and the movie would have been done. You know, something like if she had just said that, come on, and then it had cut and been done, maybe that would have felt a little bit more like the end of a Twilight Zone episode. Mm. But I think that they went a little bit further, and maybe not. I know Rod Serling was pretty good at like kind of creating sometimes doing that tension and sometimes giving somewhat of a resolution. And I feel like the movie, because it completed with her making the decision to go to Houston, it sort of completed her character arc, or at least sent it in a new direction. And I felt like I really appreciated and I liked that ending. I also kind of liked how it was a tip to people who were waiting for the Cloverfield monster, and also a slap in the face to everybody who was waiting for the Cloverfield monster. So, because I talked to Blaine like right after the movie, and Blaine and I were texting about it, and I had said that I thought it was hilarious that there would probably be a bunch of people that the movie would end and they'd be so angry that they didn't get to see the monster from Cloverfield. And Blaine said that there actually was people at his showing that were like upset, like vocally upset that the movie ended without seeing the Cloverfield monster. So I thought that was a really great sort of like, you know, 1-2 combination to fans and everything like that of Cloverfield. So I enjoyed the ending, and just, you know, I don't know what Gene is talking about, what part of the ending. So, Gene, next time, make sure your questions are a lot more clear.
So hateful.
We'll follow up about this later.
No, I think, well, I'll say this to kind of defend Gene a little bit, because I am making an assumption based on how I felt at the end. And that was, I wanted this movie to end exactly like you guys have described. She opens the door, or she, you know, she stands on top of the car or the truck or whatever, and we see that it is like an alien out there. And it closes like on her face, just like realizing that all that hard work was like Twilight Zoned for nothing, you know, like she's now out and she's still probably screwed. I think that would be the most Cloverfield way to end it, because I would have been like, I want to know what happens next. Yeah. And I think that's a great kind of mystery box, Abrams, Twilight Zone, whatever ending. Mm. And so the ending of this movie, from the time that she starts fighting with aliens on, did rub me the wrong way. And it did shade my overall opinion of the film, because I didn't want it to end that way. But when I was sitting there in my seat, when the film ended, I said, I get it. I get that this movie isn't about being a Twilight Zone episode. If it was, then that was the way to end it. This movie is about her journey. Mm. And her journey wraps up, even though obviously her journey's not over, but her character kind of journey ends when she makes that decision at the end. When she thinks she's free, everything we've talked about, when she thinks she's free, but then she has more obstacles outside, and then realizing that the obstacles will never end forces her into a decision that is antithetical to the decision she would have made at the beginning of the film. That's how the journey should have ended. So, or that's how her arc should have ended. So I didn't want there to be aliens. I wanted there to be like kind of something, or I didn't mind if there was aliens. I didn't want them to fight with the aliens. It made it too much like War of the Worlds kind of.
Oh man. I love the, and I love the War of the Worlds esque feeling to it, where she's hiding and trying to get by. But I thought it was just, I thought it was well done. I thought it was a lot of fun.
Well, no, I think it was as well done as it could have been. But it, to me, it was really jarring. Like I said, I did not appreciate it. The more I think about it, the more I like it, but it's still, I think I understand where Gene's coming from, because after, you know, sitting through, you know, like the first hour and 15 minutes, it's very jarring to suddenly become a sci-fi movie. So like I said, I get that. But actually, Wade, you've already hit on the next kind of question, because Reed Lackey, he said, not really a question, but something that he took away from the film that he'd love us to discuss is the phrase, and you hit almost every version of this without hitting his exact words, which is, just because you're correct doesn't mean you're not crazy.
Yeah.
And you said, just because you're correct doesn't mean you're good, and just because you're correct doesn't mean, you know, like I said, you knocked out a couple of those almost word for word. So, so I would ask Josh, how do I want to phrase this? How does that strike you? Did that make you really think about the fact that like someone can be right, or did it add depth to the film because you can have a character that is actually telling the truth, but is, naughty word crazy?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that what the crazy part comes from how you react to the truth, or how you handle the truth. Mm. In a way, you know, just because you have truthful information, depending on how you handle that information, can greatly affect how either people take your message or how you construe the message. And so I think, you know, going back to what we've been talking about fear, you know, how do we react to fear? Do we embrace it? Do we run away from it? Do we flip out and panic? Do we, you know, there's a bunch of different reactions that we can have to it. And in this case, Howard, who is very correct in a lot in assessing some, you know, I mean, you can
maybe even haphazardly.
But yeah, haphazardly, right? You can, you know, I mean, granted, you might be dealing in sort of creating a lot of half truths to make your truths connect together, or you know, just a bunch of different logical fallacies to get in the way. But I mean, I'm trying to think of like a good example without getting too political.
Let's
be impossible.
Yeah, I'm gonna say let's be one off political to do it then. So we all know that this is basically, I'm assuming that Reed knew I was gonna have Wade on. As we know, Wade is Wade, just telling it like it is.
Oh no,
Bearden, because he's from Texas. But just because Wade's telling it like it is doesn't mean we don't all think Wade is not crazy.
Mm. Okay,
you know. And yeah. but that in of itself it makes the podcast more interesting.
It really
there
does.
There you go. That's so what I do. But I do it in a gentle way. Hey guys.
Hey.
Hey man.
Hey guys.
You know, I appreciate your effort. But
I'm crazy.
All right. So this one, next thing, I don't think we'll be able to acquiesce to its full potential, but. Mm. And I'm gonna I apologize. I'm gonna butcher this name probably because it's my thing. But Jeremy, it's either Calcara or Calcara or Calcara or Cal something. So Jeremy asks
L.
Jeremy C. Jeremy Cal L. Says, spend about 30 minutes talking about John Goodman's best roles. so okay. a break from Cloverfield for a second, unless you want to mention it. But Josh, what is the best thing that you've seen John Goodman in? Because he's amazing.
Oh man!
Well, actually, let me stop you.
Okay.
John Goodman, amazing truth.
I would have to agree that.
Okay,
yes.
Good. Best John Goodman role.
Oh man. This was not, I didn't know we were actually going to discuss this one.
Just start naming everything that you know he's in, because it's probably the answer.
This isn't the first time he's played a monster, guys. Monsters, Inc. No. So that was a pretty good one, too, right? Yeah.
basically the same movie.
Right.
Yeah, totally.
He did really well in The Big Lebowski. You always talk about the dude, but he did really, he was my favorite part of the movie.
Oh, honestly. He is my favorite part of The Big Lebowski.
Yeah. And my son is a big fan of Curious George 3, Back to the Jungle. And so you got to give a hat tip to him there. He played a guy named Houston. So I think it's all connected, really. You know, you got Houston.
So in that film, he was probably just telling like it is because he's from Houston.
He was just telling it like it is. That's how it happens.
That's how it happens. Honestly, I feel like no one mentioned, and it's not a movie, but I remember really, really enjoying him on the Roseanne TV show. I mean, for all the things that you could say about Roseanne Barr and stuff, like, one, I think that TV show is really, really good at times, especially for when it came on and what it was doing. But gosh, he was
okay.
He was great.
I think I've narrowed it down to three.
Okay. Rapid fire.
The first one is Pacha from The Emperor's New Groove. I really enjoy that movie. It's one of my favorite animated films of all time. So I really, really enjoyed that movie. I would say that maybe number two would be, this is totally me copping out, but this would be the Coen brothers grouping of Charlie Meadows from Barton Fink, in his role in Raising Arizona. I think it's Gail or something like that.
Inside Llewyn Davis, he was there for a short period of time.
And then it was his character from Inside Llewyn Davis, who is just the strangest goofball musician, Southern guy I've ever seen in a movie. Like, not goofball in a crazy way, but just like, this guy is weird and kind of scary. He kind of reminds me maybe a little bit of Howard. I'm not sure if he's gonna go nuts or so. But by far my favorite role is, going back to my childhood, is him being Fred Flintstone. So I have no choice. I cannot divorce him from being Fred Flintstone, because he did it so well. and I loved the Flintstones. And that movie was not that great, but it made a lot of money. And I saw it like five times when I was a kid.
Well, who else could have been Fred Flintstone?
Gosh, John Goodman's twin, if he had
Rip
one.
Torn.
I don't know.
That would have been like old Fred Flintstone.
Well, I'll say this. I think one of the things I enjoyed him in a lot was Speed Racer.
I haven't seen it.
Oh my gosh. So let me say this, because I don't think enough people talk about this film. I understand like what the Wachowski brothers, sisters, whatever they are now. I understand the pitfalls of most of their movies, but I absolutely love and think it's one of the most beautiful movies I've ever seen is Speed Racer.
I saw Elijah Davidson from Real Spirituality tweet today that it was visually one of the most interesting movies he's ever seen.
Yeah.
So I need to check it out.
When I saw what they did on screen with Speed Racer, it's one of those times where I was like, it's like when I watched The Matrix, I was like, I did not know people could do that in a movie, and it works. So, but when John Goodman's pops in Speed Racer is perfect, along with many other things about that movie that I super enjoy. So I can't recommend Speed Racer enough. I think easily my favorite Wachowski movie, above The Matrix, personal.
Wow.
So, just to say, John Goodman rolls. Check done there. I want to say this, that Aaron White also he had like 16 questions for us, and I think we answered most of them through other people's questions, except for the thing that we were going to talk about at the very end anyway, which is possible tie-in theories with Cloverfield. Now
Wade's been waiting the whole episode.
I know,
for this.
I know he has. And yes, you've been very patient, Wade. I appreciate it.
That's all I wanted to talk about. Seriously.
You're like, what do I have to say? How long do I have to make up stuff until the end? Okay.
I just saying whatever came to mind. Now I got my notebooks here.
Yeah. Nice.
I can see him like licking a finger, flipping the pages. So I'll start it by saying that Trachtenberg he claims that the film doesn't take place in the same universe as Cloverfield, but Abrams has called it a spiritual successor. Mm-hmm. Despite these claims or admissions, we still have theories. So, Josh, what is your theory?
Wait, why really am I going low. First?
That was that really was low of you, man.
That was a misdirect.
No, let's hear what Josh says. It would stink if Josh says the same thing that I was gonna say.
Oh, do you only have one? I assumed that you had an entire
honestly an entire Wade, notebook. if you've thought about this for more than 5 minutes, you
I you have, would... but it's probably not anything new, but
okay,
you know. Okay, Wade. Josh forfeits his turn. Wade, you go.
Well,
okay.
Wait, all right.
Okay, you guys ready? Point one of 227. No, it's really not, you know, a big thing. So I think for me, I went in, and I think the surprise for me is I'm thinking that it is a sequel set in the same universe. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So as I'm watching, it's very clear that this movie is 2015, 2016, somewhere around then. They have the new iPhones. It says 2015 on their registration sticker. So it's somewhere around there. The date for the original Cloverfield was 2008. The manga that came out to describe the monster in the first Cloverfield, it's said to come from the depths of the ocean. And there was a company that was extracting some sort of materials or substance from that animal. It woke up and it attacked. And then there are all these questions that maybe it attacked Japan and then went to New York or Australia. Well, before hitting New York, of course. So for me, as I'm watching this, if it's set in the same universe, when Howard said, hey, we've been attacked, they would have probably talked about the New York attack, right? That would have been on their mind. It would have been a much more of a possibility. Then it seems very clear that these are monsters from another universe, right? So you get some mix up there. Here's what I think it is. I don't think it's in the same universe. If it is, they'd have to go away with the manga, or they'd have to say that it was kind of a sleeper, like World of the Worlds, War of the Worlds, and when the aliens came, it woke them up, something like that. So what I really think is Cloverfield is a title that J.J. Abrams and Bad Robot have given to films to describe monster movies that are based in these intimate portraits of characters, and they add the term, you know, Cloverfield to that. And I think we might see some other Cloverfield movies, but they'll just be movies with monsters set around a couple of different characters for a small period of time. So it's more like an anthropology type series. That's kind of my theory on it. Maybe you agree, maybe you disagree.
So what you're saying is whenever they make the remake of the movie Monsters that Gareth Edwards did, they'll call it Cloverfield in South America?
They would make a movie like Cloverfield.
Did you just say El Cloverfield?
El Cloverfield.
Maybe I did.
Yo quiero.
No, it's like, yo soy El Cloverfield.
That's what he says.
Which is Spanish for the Cloverfield.
So that's kind of my theory on it, which I love monster movies, and I love the intimate focus that it brings, whether it's found footage or whether it's this close quarters that we see in the bunker, you know, getting us not really into this big full-on war, but just giving us little glimpses of that war through characters' eyes. I think that that could be a really interesting thing.
Mm. No, so what I like about that is, well, one, I think it does back up what Abrams is saying as it's its spiritual successor. But I like the fact that they seem to understand that monster movies give us a chance to examine something in the human DNA, you know, like inside humanity. And instead of giving us a huge monster movie where we only get snippets of what we probably think those things are, they're like, look, we're going to use the instead of using kind of these characters as backdrops to show you monster set pieces, we're going to use these character, like these depth of character stories and character arcs, kind of like with a little bit of backdrop of monsters to help like pull those truths or pull those ideas out. So they basically flip the script on a monster movie and put the things that if we were doing this episode on, again, like Godzilla or something, we would be having to, I would say, try a lot harder to get at what the heart of the film was based on what the characters were going through. In this case, we don't have to try very hard because that's the point. So I love that they have this, whatever it is with monster films, where they have the ability to turn them all on their head and give us more of what we actually connect with in monster movies anyway.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the beauty of monster movies. Like, I just even think of, like, it would never be classified as a monster movie, but, like, I just, in anticipation of this and the connection between this and, like, Alfred Hitchcock movies, I watched Psycho, and I feel like that's a monster movie, even though there's no monsters in it. Because clearly, you know, Norman Bates is supposed to be a monster, but, you know, we can't get exploitation. Well, we can get exploitation movies, but we can't get 5,000 Godzilla movies out of a Norman Bates movie until, you know, they made Bates Motel. So now they got something out of it. But, I mean, that's the beauty of monster movies, is that they should be doing exactly what you were just talking about.
Mm-hmm. Well, with that, I think we've made it through most of the questions. So
we'll just have to set the rest aside.
So I was going to say, if someone else left one, I didn't get to see it in time before the show. Sorry. Thanks for submitting it. Your questions are valuable to us. Obviously, we just answered a whole bunch of them. So,
good corporate answer.
Yeah, corporate answer. please find us at Real World. Whatever. So I want to wrap us down because we're about that time. So, Wade. You obviously love this movie a lot.
Yeah, I liked it. Yeah, I gave it like 4 out of 5 stars.
Yeah, because really you liked it more than Room. Yeah, and so that says a lot, I think.
Scandalous.
Well, I don't know.
Okay. So you really enjoyed the film, but you mm-hmm. could find something wrong with it. What was your come on moment? What was something that you didn't enjoy?
Yeah, you know, there were very little flubs in this movie, I thought. That doesn't mean it reached the highest heights, but I thought it was just very good all around. The one thing that I wondered about, and maybe this was because he wanted to add complexity to the film. I think it was. But when Howard knows something's up and he pulls out that, you know, huge vat of acid
mm-hmm.
and Emmett decides to fall on the sword and he makes up this excuse that he's trying to get to Howard's gun. For some reason, I didn't know why he made up that type of excuse, going for the gun when he could have said, well, we were trying to, we didn't know if this thing was going to fall apart. So we were planning just in case, but we were worried you would get your feelings hurt. You know, he went just straight for, hey, we were, you know, wanted to get your gun. I didn't think a character would say that in that situation. And so for me, that was like, you know, I don't know. But at the same time, it adds to the complexity when Howard kills him, because you're like, oh, well, maybe he's protecting himself. And if he would have said, hey, we were just trying to, you know, put a suit together, whatever, then it wouldn't be as complex. So that was kind of my, okay, I think I know why you're doing it, but it didn't seem true to what a normal person would do in that situation.
Mm.
Hmm.
Well, I did see him as trying to flatter him. Remember, because yeah. he said, I wanted her to respect me like she obviously does.
Yeah.
You.
Yeah.
So it seemed like he was trying to do a couple things. And mm-hmm. it didn't seem totally off to me. But, I mean, as soon as he would have rolled out a vat of that stuff, I'd have been like, I'm going to go to another room. Y'all can have a conversation.
You know, and it's a small deal. Yeah. It really is, mm-hmm. you know, in this film.
So, Josh, same thing?
Not necessarily the same moment, although I kind of agree with Wade. Just sort of the fact that I guess maybe you can write off every decision in a movie by being like, well, sometimes people make stupid decisions, you know? So, But anyways, the original moment that kind of left a bad taste in my mouth that I eventually got over once I got a chance to think about the movie is when I walked out, is I felt like, you know, the Chekhov's bottle of liquor that made a couple, like an appearance in the opening scene, you know, she kind of debated taking it with her. And then she takes it with her in the car, and then it's mentioned again or something like that during the course of the film. You know, they said something about like not remembering to bring in the bottle of liquor or something like that. And, you know, then it shows up to be the catalyst for her to be able to defeat the alien. Originally, I was kind of like, that kind of feels a little bit like Signs, you know,
and little Shyamalan.
Yeah, it felt a little bit like too convenient for me. But eventually I was kind of like, oh, okay, well, it's not the same as something that Shyamalan has done in the past, you know, where it's like it wasn't absurd. And it wasn't like the, you know, the wife's dying words is just so that she can, you know, be able to do something, you know, like the whole point of her dying is so that they're able to stop the alien invasion. Like, it's, you know, it's not as contrived and, you know, purposely manipulative as that. It was just kind of
I love that movie. I think it's great.
Wait,
I know this, but this is a Chekhov's gun type situation. Like the moment you get that close-up shot as she's leaving her home and she grabs the bottle, like, okay, I'm pretty sure like we're gonna use this again.
Yeah, you know, like, and I guess that's what originally kind of turned me, like, I was like that, because I think I said that right when I got back from the movie. I was talking to Gene and Mikey about just kind of our thought, because I was the last one of the four of us kind of on staff people at Real World to see it, because I had been avoiding talking to them because I didn't want to know what happened and what the movie was like. So, and during the movie, they're going on prattling on Slack together about the movie, and I just had to shut off my phone because I didn't want the movie to be spoiled for me. And that
kind of does sound like us. We do prattle a lot.
Prattlers.
Prattlers. So anyways, that eventually I kind of got over that, I guess. So that was the closest that I got to a come on moment, because the only other come on moment is I wish that Cannibal Airlines was a real movie.
There you go. I wish it was too. It sounds incredible.
So I honestly did. I got home and I looked for it and it wasn't there. It's not a real movie. They made it up for the movie, so which is unfortunate.
Well, I would say that the only thing that really made me say, like, okay, this is convenient, or we're doing this for convenience, is once the fire starts in the bunker. Like, we already saw how long it took her to crawl through the vents. Mm. But when she has to crawl through it with a fire, like, we skip the hard part about crawling through the vents, and she magically crawls through the vents super fast. And I don't, for some reason, it really bothered me. I'm like, it took you forever the first time. It takes a while to crawl through a vent when you can barely fit into it, based on obviously lots of research that I've done. Vent crawling. I've watched Die Hard like 100 times.
Many times I've crawled through vents.
Yeah, like I said, I watched Die Hard a lot of times, guys. So I'm pretty up to speed on vent crawling. And it just seemed like, I was like, can you not just jump across the fire and like go out the front door? Like, is it really that, like, it's just starting? Is it too intense right now? Instead of, you know, this is going to spread and there's going to be lots of smoke and things that I can't get rid of. Let's slowly crawl through a ventilation shaft and hope I can get out in time. But I realize, you know, the reason that they did it is because they already introduced it before, you know, as a way out. So I don't know why it bothered me so much. It probably shouldn't have, but hey, positive time. Lots of good things about this film. Lots of good things this film did. So, Wade, what was your favorite part of this film?
So I was thinking about that because I knew you would ask that question. And I think for me, probably my favorite part is Mary Elizabeth Winstead's performance. And particularly because we get these close-ups, you really can see a lot of her eye movement, right? And at the beginning of the film, her eyes are moving very quickly back and forth. It's kind of like we mentioned, this fearful flight type situation. But then at moments, she clicks. Now, overall, her eyes get steadfast, right? You see this resolve come in. But there's multiple climaxes kind of throughout that, whether she's at the dinner table. But she hatches this plan, and she's hyper-focused. And you can just see that in her eyes. And that carries towards the end of the film when she's no longer moving back and forth. She's straightforward. She's resolved. You can contrast that to Goodman's character. He is very, very relaxed. And then when he gets rattled, he starts fidgeting. He starts moving. So it's the opposite of Winstead's character, in that she is still, she's confident. She's very, you know, she's a MacGyver of sorts. And I think just being able to see those close-ups, being able to see her eye movements, her performance is very, very good here. And I think it was probably my favorite part of the movie.
Mm. I can't really argue with that. Josh, not that you could argue with that, but what is your favorite part?
I think one of my favorite parts is it's a couple different moments, but I think there's these great moments where they're you know, Wade, you had mentioned a lot earlier in the podcast that there was kind of this mixing of genres. And I feel like the movie does a really good job of playing with some of our expectations of what these different dramas should be doing at different points in the movie. Like, I think about this one point where she first is trying to get out of this room that she mysteriously wakes up in. And, you know, she hasn't met Howard yet. She hasn't. She's trying to figure out basically how to get out, and she takes her crutch and she like kind of shaves it down and fashions it into a poking device and tries to get the attention of, you know, she's basically going to try and do something, and she's going to wait for the person to come through the door, and she's sitting there and the music is swelling and everything like that, and she's just waiting, and we're all like, oh, he's gonna come through the door and she's gonna stab her and trying to run away or whatever, she's gonna get caught, and then this music sort of just stops, and you know, she goes like, ugh, like she's got to think of a different plan.
I love
that's kind of that encapsulated sort of like this, there's more subtle dynamics playing around, but I feel like that's one of the more obvious moments where they're playing with what you expect this movie to be. And so I really appreciated that moment where it was kind of like the music playing and all this stuff kind of went together, and then it's just sort of like a big letdown. And you know, it's if you had been really expecting something to happen, you just been like, oh man, it didn't happen, you know. And I think like something that I thought about throughout this entire movie is like, there was a bad movie under all of this. There was a really bad like thriller movie underneath all this, and they did such a good job of making all the right choices and toying with our expectations that it made it a lot better. And you know, I know obviously some of that's probably the development of the spec script that it originally was and all this other stuff, but I really feel like this movie could have been just generic kind of blah thriller, you know, or it could have just, you know, gone into being some sci-fi explosion movie or whatever, you know, like, ah, the bunker, they go out and there's aliens everywhere kind of thing. So I don't know. I've underneath all the layers of good decisions, there was like, there was a bad movie under all of it, but I'm so glad that it was further down and they made the right decisions so with this movie.
It was so far down underground.
It was.
It's probably locked in a bunker somewhere. Who got jokes? I never really thought about it that way, Josh. This does have all the pieces to be like a straight to video or straight to whatever things go to, straight to Netflix, you know, kind of whatever. And it, they just did it well. Mm-hmm. And I think this made some really smart decisions, which is really impressive. And I think it shows you the very, very small dial turn, you know, like the same amount of space in between hot and cold in your shower is is how close movies can be from being completely terrible to really good. So
that's a great analogy.
and for myself, I would say that I want to give a lot of props to John Gallagher Jr., who plays Emmett in this movie.
Yeah.
Because he, the last three things I have seen him in, I have absolutely loved. So it was this.
Really?
Short Term 12,
yeah.
The Newsroom.
Yeah. Okay.
So, I mean, you know, Newsroom, Short Term 12, and this. I've loved him in all three of those things. And as irony would have it, or luck or fate or whatever proper English term for this is, I'm currently working my way through the West Wing. Not physically, but, I'm not at the White House, I guess, whatever, but the TV show. So I'm working through, the West Wing for the first time. And just today I watched the episode, where John Gallagher Jr. is a little, like, he's a kid in one of the episodes. And I'm like, is that guy? I was like, is that him? And it's the one of his first things that he was ever on and, or ever in. Which maybe why Sorkin picks him up later for the Newsroom. Who knows? I've just really enjoyed him. Like I said, he wrecks me in Short Term 12. He is one of the best parts of the Newsroom, and I enjoyed him here. So not just because of his acting, but just in general, I love the character of Emmett. And I think it's obviously terrible. And I didn't want it to happen, but I think specifically my favorite moment is when he dies. And it's not because I wanted him to die, but when he gets shot, even though I kind of felt like I saw it coming once he started giving his little speech, it confirmed that things were real. Like, she needed to get out of there. Like, before I was like, well, he's a little crazy. You know, you hadn't really seen how bad the monster was in Howard. And when Howard kills Emmett, as much as I love Emmett, it proves that Howard is not somebody that you can share space with. And mm-hmm. like I said, the stakes of the movie had already been gradually going up, and it just spiked. And so it totally worked for me.
Hmm. So, well, Mikey, one more thing is John Gallagher Jr. is in the South by Southwest hit movie Hush, which is a horror movie about a deaf woman who gets stalked by a killer. And that comes out on Netflix tomorrow, April 8th. Yes.
Well, that sounds like a lot of fun.
Which by the time this comes out will be in the past.
What?
I'm going to have to, maybe that'll be my Netflix recommendation as well.
Oh, hey guys, it's Future Josh. It's a really great movie.
I loved it so much.
Future Josh.
Oh man.
Their second instance of time travel in this podcast.
Well, to be fair, the stuff that I've seen him in, I think he's done really well, but it's not that he was hurting for cast or writers or the people he was working with and the things that I liked him in. So, I mean, I don't think that he is beyond reproach, but so far he has been, his agent or him or whoever is getting him these roles has been choosing wisely. So, all right. So to wrap up, finally, Wade, do you have any final thoughts that we have not covered? Anything else you wanted to mention?
You know, like I mentioned, I was listening to Film Spotting, and Josh Larson had mentioned that now it kind of sets the franchise up to go to Houston for Cloverfield Houston. And so I just want to say that we should petition and really get it here, because I think it would be great. Richard Linklater can direct it. It's a character study, a small window of time, which fits him well. And we could even kind of have maybe some slackers in it, or Bernie. Bernie's out of jail, so we could do something like that. But no, hey, thanks so much for allowing me to come on. I really appreciate it and enjoyed this movie.
No, it's always a pleasure, Wade. Let's see, Josh, final thoughts?
Oh, man. Yeah, Wade kind of stole my thunder. I was going to say, I was looking forward to getting a TV series. Maybe I'll go in a different direction. Cloverfield TV series where J.J. Abrams shows up at the beginning of every episode and very Rod Serling or Alfred Hitchcock-like is like, you know, like, consider a world and, you know, gives us like, welcome to Cloverfield. And, you know, then we get an episode like 10 Cloverfield Lane or like Cloverfield or something like that. I would actually, you know what? I mean, if that ever happened, and I'm kind of being, I was being a little facetious, but now I think I've convinced myself that I'd actually pretty much watch that.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, obviously even better if instead of like the announcer type guy, J.J. Abrams showed up and did more of a crypt keeper kind of thing. Exactly.
Perfect.
All right. Well, I did enjoy this film. I didn't love this film. I did enjoy it. Like I said, I did have some mixed feelings about the end of it, but I think it gives us so much to talk about, and I think it's well worth your time. And I honestly do. I do feel sorry for anyone who listened to this entire episode without having seen the movie first, because we did ruin it. It's a movie that will reward you on repeat viewings, but probably nothing will be as good as watching it that first time. The suspense of the first watch. So, I hope that everyone did enjoy their first watch through. I hope that you saw lots of the things that we got to see and the metaphors that we got to go along with and kind of see how those things are a reflection of what we see every day in humanity in different kind of spheres. So like a good monster movie or apocalyptic movie or horror movie or a thriller or a suspense movie can. So, with that, these conversations are not possible without amazing guests. So, Wade, how can people find whatever it is that you're doing when you're not guesting on Real World Theology?
You know, I think that probably the best way would be just to kind of follow me on Twitter. My handle is at Wade Hance, WadeHance. And so I kind of post what I write and my podcast links up there. So definitely do that. And then as a supplement to this, we do a weekly show at Christ and Pop Culture for our podcast, Seeing and Believing. And I would encourage you to subscribe to it. So like I said, it's very different. We don't do spoilers. We usually limit our discussion to like maybe 30 minutes. And then we also include subjects like this past week. We talked about Terrence Malick's Night of Cups, but then we ended with a segment on regional filmmaking. And so we each gave five films that we thought were great that were set in our respective city. So I gave five films from Houston, and then my co-host Kevin gave five from Chicago. So we do a lot of those different things. So yeah, I would encourage you to subscribe to that. And I have a website, wadebearden.com. I try to post some of my stuff there too, links to it anyway, when I don't forget. So that's that. Follow me on Letterboxd too. I love Letterboxd. send me a message, yeah, and I'll follow you back. Just let me know. And I really enjoy that. I think it's a lot of fun, and I need some more people to follow. So yeah, definitely do that. It's Letterboxd. It's at Wade Hance, or I guess letterboxd.com/WadeHance. So yeah, definitely do that.
Well, that makes me have two real quick questions. One, since I have not had a chance to listen to it, did Cloverfield Houston make your list of regional movies?
It's up there for like ones that haven't been made yet. That one, and then the one about the Houston NFL team winning the Super Bowl. I'm still waiting on that. It has to happen.
I'll
do a story on it. But no, so I had Paris, Texas for the first one, because the final third act takes place in Houston. I had Boyhood, had some other movies. But yeah, so it was a lot of fun. It was cool. And Kevin had The Fugitive and like The Dark Knight for Chicago. It was really great. He had a great list. So
you're like, oh, things happen in Chicago.
Yeah, things happen in Chicago, right?
Oh, I guess the second thing is it makes a lot of sense, because I didn't see the correlation at first. But when I think about it, I obviously see how you could start with Knight of Cups and then say, oh, well, let's talk about films that are obviously better than Knight of Cups. So anything regional, probably anything that like a high school kid made, would be more entertaining than having to sit through Knight of Cups.
Knight of Cups is one of my favorite movies of the year. Oh. I think it's fantastic. I can't shake that movie. You know, Kevin didn't like it as much, but I absolutely loved it. Matt Zoller Seiss has a great review on RogerEbert.com. Brent McCracken has a great review on ChristianityToday.com. So I would encourage people to read those reviews before you go see the movie. But if you can see it, like, it's different, and a lot of people aren't going to like it. But to me, it really spoke to I felt like these real like spiritual themes, and I like Malick. So
yeah,
so,
you and Blaine.
A lot of people is named Mikey Fissel.
Yeah, you and Blaine. Meanwhile, if you follow me on Letterboxd, you'll see that I gave it half a star.
Wow.
Because it's one of the worst movies I've ever had to sit through in my entire life.
Oh, wow.
So boring.
The worst. What'd you give Batman Superman?
Two and a half.
Two and a half? Oh, my gosh. I don't know what to say anymore.
You should say, Terrence Malick, please make a movie that actually has coherence. Because because I just want to get in a fight about this on this podcast. I've read those reviews, and those reviews are like when I read reviews for Inside Llewyn Davis. I was like, well, someone tell me what Inside Llewyn Davis is about. It's beautiful, and I love Oscar Isaac so much, but nothing happened in this movie.
What?
And I'm reading
Llewyn
reviews.
Davis is like, I love Inside Llewyn Davis.
I read a review of a Terrence Malick film, and it reads like this. There's so many images, and Malick has a unique style. I'm like, you're not telling me anything about this movie. You're just describing how Terrence Malick makes movies.
No, you got to read like Matt Zoller Seiss. You got to read Brent McCracken on him. They provide. They're great. I don't know how to write about a film because there's that film. There's so much. But you should listen to our podcast. We have another guy on there, David Rourke. He liked it too. Oh man, Inside Llewyn Davis too. I love that movie. I think that movie's fantastic.
Oh, there's lots of great things about it. I just don't think it has. Anyway, it doesn't matter. I really wanted to bait it so that
next you're gonna be telling me you didn't like God's Not Dead or something.
We all belly laugh, chuckle, chuckle. No, I really wanted to just give Blaine more fuel to not have to take my crap about not liking the movie since he liked it so much, and he's a big Malick fan. But, okay, Josh.
Yeah.
I didn't forget about you. I promise I didn't forget about you. How can people follow what you do?
No, that's okay. That was wildly entertaining. hi, everyone. Hey, I'm Josh. You can find me on Twitter. My Twitter handle is, hey, it's that Josh.
Lots of surprise.
Yeah. You can find me on the Facebook for Movie Lovers, Letterboxd. Haven't been as active on it this week, so I'm almost ashamed to say that I have to record a podcast in a week that I have not been on Letterboxd very much. But don't worry, everyone, I'll get it updated, say something snarky, and you can talk about the movie. So yay. I love being on there. And everything that I do, whether it's talking or writing, is for Real World Theology. Have weekly articles, lots of other stuff. You can read my reaction to the Rogue One trailer from today, which I was very excited about and was trying to work into this episode. So mission accomplished. Okay. So yeah, you can find me on Real World Theology. And thanks for listening. And thanks for having me on, Mikey.
Hey, it's great to have you on, Josh. Well, does that sound sincere?
Sincere enough.
That works for me. Well, if you want to follow me at all, you can follow me on Twitter, where I will never be talking positively about Terrence Malick, at Fizzification. And as always, don't forget to subscribe to the podcast if you've enjoyed it in any way. You can do that at iTunes or a myriad of other places. Please leave us feedback. We love it. We're very grateful to people like Wade and Josh who take time to have these conversations. Please, please follow them. Follow the work they do. Give them likes or reviews or whatever you can, whatever their work allows you to do, please give them positive feedback. And I am so thankful that you, the listener, have taken time to not only be a part of this conversation already by giving us questions, but listening to this episode, hopefully enjoying it and keeping the conversation going afterwards. So thank you so much for taking part of your week to do that. And until next episode, please remember that story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless. Bye-bye.
This podcast has been a Real World Theology production. For more information, check out realworldtheology.com. And thanks for listening.
Now this is podcasting. Woo!
There, I don't know what that means exactly.
Now he's a regular tree of life.
Mm-hmm. I'm a tree. Oh,
he is. He I is.
Love that. Me too. I love it. Which Fizz probably hates it, but I don't care.
Well, I mean, every time I think of Wade, I think about what the days of heaven are going to be like.
That's good. Yeah. Right? It's just like a good old, well, good night of cups, everybody. I'll be here all night.
All right. Well, I'm getting these thin red lines under my eyes. I need to go to bed.
Actually, you should probably see a doctor for that.
Yeah. I'm from Texas. I can talk about Gilmore Girls when I want. Nobody
gets that. Oh, that's definitely making the show.